From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Tackling Canada thistle and the ethics of herbicide use, moss in the lawn or garden beds, pesky squirrels, propagating philodendron. Those are among the questions you've been asking me lately, and my friend Ken Drews of kendrews.com is here to help answer in the latest edition of our Urgent Garden Question Shows. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Welcome back, Ken, and everyone, to the latest Q&A segment. We've got lots of questions coming via email and on Facebook at facebook.com/awaytogarden all the time. Thank you, and keep it up, everyone. But I have to say, I was surprised, Ken. Hello, Ken. Ken.
Hello.
Are you, Ken? Hello. Hello, Ken.
Here I am.
Oh, good.
Ready, willing, able.
Oh, good. I was surprised not to get any amaryllis questions this whole last winter at all. Usually I get, you know, how do I rebloom it from last year's bulbs, whatever. Yeah. So that was one that didn't show up. That's one of my usuals.
Why?
Why is it one of my usuals and why didn't it show up?
No. I'm surprised, frankly.
Okay, yeah, me too.
That's always the question.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I've had amaryllis for years unsuccessfully, and they have these strappy leaves and they look terrible, and maybe they get mealybug, maybe they don't, and they never bloom again. But last year I was determined to get my amaryllis, at least one, to bloom again.
Oh.
And I did.
Oh, okay. And you did it by?
Well, I kept it in a really good place, lots of bright light through the summer, and watered it and fed it a little bit with a balanced organic fertilizer, kind of a like a 5-5-5 or something like that. And then in September, I moved it still outside, but to a spot where it wouldn't get any rain. And it's not over potted. It's in a terracotta pot that's just a little bit bigger than the bulb. And I let the leaves stay on, and they started to not look so good. And then they got a little yellow, and I just cut off the yellow leaves. I didn't cut it back like when you buy it, but
right.
I brought it inside, and in January, it's sent up its flower spike, and I'm going to do it to all the bulbs next year for sure.
So just let me be clear. So you moved it, and then eventually you moved it into indoors, right? And you didn't water for how long? How long were you resting the bulb, so to speak?
Well, I started resting it really
September-ish?
Middle of August. I stopped watering it.
Okay.
And then I moved it just so it wouldn't get any rain.
Yeah.
And then I brought it in before the killing frost, which is mid-October or so. And then I put it in a very bright, sunny window, but didn't water it. I didn't water it at all until it started showing that flower spike.
Okay. Okay.
I didn't repot it. I kept it in the same pot.
Okay. One of the things I found is that I can rebloom them after the first year of them skipping. In other words, they're on somebody else's schedule, like from the grower, you know, the first year on the anniversary of when I got them, right? And
yeah.
I have trouble that year getting them used to my system. But if I stick to it, I can get them to do it after that. And maybe I'm associating, conflating thoughts, but I sort of felt like I don't have the same conditions as where they were used to, you know?
I think what's happening is that when you buy them, they're all juiced up. They've been growing
yeah.
in perfect conditions
yeah.
with lots of fertilizer. And they're taking a year off because they've used up their energy and they have to rebuild.
Well, and I even used to just throw them in the, put the pots in the pantry or, you know, under the sink or, you know, just like nowhere.
I thought
still.
You were going to say in the compost.
No. Just, you know, but I mean, like rest as in total neglect really is what was going on. You know, it wasn't a decent, it wasn't a great spot. So, all right.
You've
so you
had
16...
good luck with Clivia too.
Yeah. I have my grandmother's old ones from, you know, I mean, we're talking, I don't know how old they are. They're certainly 50 years old. Isn't
wow.
that weird? Yeah, crazy. So, all right, so there we go. We get an extra question and answer, even though nobody else asked. I asked.
But they were all thinking about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. So should we take maybe the easiest question that was submitted first, or I don't know, maybe it's the hardest question, depending on how you, which is squirrels. Marianne.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Marianne wrote in, for the first time last summer, squirrels ate my tomatoes as soon as they started turning red or yellow or just plain ripe. Her neighbor had the same problem. And she said, of course, squirrels have dug things up in the past, but nothing like this. And she wonders, as does her neighbor, is there some way they can keep the squirrels off the ripening fruit? Must they cage each plant with chicken wire, et cetera? So, I mean, what do you, you know, I know what my answer is. My answer is flip and rude, right? Which is, there's no hope. You know what I mean? I mean, squirrels are demonic.
Well, squirrels are demonic, yes. And as you might know, when I was working on this house where I am now, I rented another house and there were chipmunks. And the chipmunks ate they didn't eat the whole fruit, you know? They just ate like a third of each fruit.
Yes.
I suppose one thing you could do is pick them green and ripen them inside, but then what's the point?
Right. No, I know.
And as years ago, many years ago, I used to use mothballs. Mothballs are bad for us.
Oh, they're horrible. And, you know, they're labeled. It's illegal to use them for other purposes than in a container in the closet.
If you can even get them, because now I think they're banned
right.
in some places,
They're super dangerous, yeah.
However, when I planted the woodland garden, you were saying about squirrels digging up stuff,
yeah.
et cetera. And I probably mentioned this before, but I use dryer sheets.
Yeah, that's what they say. And I've done that sometimes in my tractor. In the and this is against mice and chipmunks and whomever, but in my tractor in the barn, for some reason they love to go in the engine compartment and make a nest and whatever. And you know, probably people have had it under the hood of their car. And dryer sheets are one of the things that is recommended. However, I mean, I don't think we can necessarily disincent all the local squirrels from all of our outdoor plants with, an infinite number. I mean, the caging really is what Marianne is hinting at. The caging is the only thing, and even that is not a great solution. And it becomes ridiculous. And so we don't have a good answer, do we? Because squirrels really are a nuisance.
Maybe grow more plants. No, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, but I think you're right about it. It's either caging or it's harvesting a little early and ripening indoors, unfortunately.
Right.
Susan, in the comments on the website, on awaytogarden.com, asked a question about propagating philodendron. She says, I want to learn how to propagate philodendron. Can I do it with cuttings in water? Is that something you've ever done?
I know you hate these yes and no answers, but yes.
Okay. All right, good. We'll move on to the next question.
Next. You know, there's very few things that I propagate in water because the roots that form in water are unlike the roots that form in a medium such as perlite, something like that, which are fibrous and thin. But the roots in water, as everyone's noticed, are kind of thick and white because they have to get oxygen out of the water, which is a completely different kind of medium, if you can call it that.
You know, I remember coming to your house in Brooklyn, these many generations ago, when you had your garden in Brooklyn. And I remember on the windowsill you had a glass of something propagating. And it wasn't really propagating. What it turned out to be was willow twigs in a vessel, in a water jar. And you were making willow water, you told me. Is that a true thing?
Yeah, that's a true thing. 'Cause willows love water, and they do root in water. And it's one of the few things that I actually root in water. But they have hormones, natural hormones, and they encourage things to root. So I would use the willow water as a kind of organic rooting hormone to help some things along. But as I'm thinking of this and we're talking, I root some begonias in water, and I root philodendron vines in water. But I think an important thing is to then move it to a potting medium when the roots are between 1 and 2 inches long. Don't let them be in there for
don't get spaghetti.
Years.
Right.
Because they're just not going to make the transition easily to a medium which you want them to be in, because they can't really – well, the philodendron would live for years in water, but it's not going to be a great plant.
But I'm inferring that you have other tactics that you probably would recommend more. Is that –
No, I think water for philodendron vines is fine.
Okay. Okay.
I'll just tell you, I got asked that question recently, and someone said, how come it wasn't rooting? And the answer was winter. And he said, how do they know? They know.
Interesting.
Almost everything knows. They kind of take a semi-dormancy. And
interesting.
Things that will root really fast in the spring.
Well, you just said,
sort of sit around.
You just said the word hormones, and I am assuming that day length and whatever triggers that the triggers to grow have to do with probably the release of certain chemical elements, whether they're hormones, they probably are some kind of hormones. And mm-hmm. if those aren't in plentiful supply, it probably doesn't happen, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so vining philodendron, we can put it in water, but get it out soon enough before those roots become total spaghetti or thread, right. filling the whole jar. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you propagating anything else over there? Because you're the author of course, Making More Plants, as I always like to tell people. That's why I always ask you these propagation questions.
I'm propagating a lot of things. I haven't started a lot of the seeds for summer yet. Because,
okay.
You know, as you know, some of them want to be in under lights for 5 weeks, and we're not there yet.
Okay.
5 weeks before frost. But I've gotten really into trying to track down fragrant violets.
Oh.
And when was the last time you smelled a violet that had a smell?
Yeah. So you mean like perennial outdoor kind of things, not African violets, just so people aren't confused. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, they're perennial, but they're zone 7, I think.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to be careful how I grow them. And I'm going to grow them in pots. But I got some Parma violets. There used to be,
Parma,
I mean, 100
right.
years ago, there were 20 kinds of fragrant violets. They're double. They smell incredible. And, you know, people talk about violet smell, but who's ever even smelled a violet?
Right,
because
anymore.
For
right, right.
Like 20 years, there haven't been any.
Right. So you got these from?
I got them from Select Seeds.
Yeah, okay. And you got little plants or you got seeds?
I got little plants.
Okay.
I don't think they make seeds because they're double, you know. So
okay.
I think you have to propagate them vegetatively. And they grow in a way, they kind of make runners like a strawberry a little bit, or not quite like a spider plant, but they make little runners that say, root me, root me. You can just look at them.
They say
and
that.
Imagine
uh-huh.
they're going to be
rooted.
And
you're drinking what?
So I don't cut them off from the mother plant. I put a little pot next to the pot, and with a hairpin, I pin the little plantlets that are growing on thin little side shoots. There's a place where they just look like they're going to be new plants, and I pin those to a medium that I keep moist. And then when they start to show new growth, they're rooted, and you can cut them off from the original plant, and then you have more. And what am I going to do with 30 violets? Well, I think they'll make great gifts, don't you?
Oh, yeah. So now these plants are next to each other?
Right, next to each other. And I don't, you can picture with a spider plant
yeah.
has all the little
yeah,
spiders.
Yeah, so it's like a baby.
Yeah, you just can put some pots around and have the pot and the mother plant in the middle and then peg them to some soil. They'll root in. Spider plants would be easy. Strawberries would do it too, you know, like
okay.
that awful pink panda strawberry
yeah,
if you
yeah.
ever wanted more of those.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. So the mother plant gives off little baby plants.
Yeah. And I call them daughter pots.
Okay. Oh, good. All right. So fragrant violets, a great way to get more of those if one invests in some. All right.
Well,
so.
There used to be 400 greenhouses in Rhinebeck, New York that would grow violets and send them down the Hudson to New York City for the ladies who would take them to the opera when they wanted to smell nice things until about 1910.
And not anymore. All right.
Not anymore.
Well, at Ken's house, they're happening.
We're bringing them back.
Okay. So I got a question from Anne from Wisconsin, Zone 5, and she said she has moss, and she says moss has even invaded some of her grass. It seems to be everywhere, not just shady spots like it used to be. And she's wondering, so it's in perennial beds and it's in the grass, and she's wondering why and so forth. And so there's one kind of obvious thing that, you know, they say, like, read your weeds, you know, sometimes they say, you know, like you can sort of infer from what weeds show up, what conditions are out of whack. And one is, of course,
acidity.
Yeah. So that it may be too acidic. The area might need liming or whatever. But it's an indicator. It can be of other conditions, too. Like, did the soil there get water in these areas get more waterlogged? Like, has something changed in the way the area drains, or is there more compaction?
Definitely.
So either if something uphill from there changed or something else that has reduced the organic matter in the soil, let's not mention invasive worms again, but okay, whatever. So looking at all those things, compaction, drainage, like you said, acidity. And then I think cultivating, right, as well. I mean, breaking it up. But compaction, that's where I see it the most, where I see that happen. Even if nothing's changed in the pH specifically, do you know what I mean? It's the compaction that does it, yeah. So
maybe it's an area of lawn that they walk on a lot or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, and that's what I find where I get it, exactly.
When you have a garden tour, right, your lawn gets all pressed down.
I know, what a mess.
Usually when we have moss, we're thrilled to have moss if it's in the right place. But
yeah.
If it's in the wrong place, it's in the way. You know, I think that liming, well, doing a soil test might be a good idea.
Grass
wants it a little alkaline.
Yeah.
And moss wants it a little acid. And I think she could probably just put some lime and some compost over those areas and see what happens. I don't think she'd have to really churn it up a whole lot.
I was thinking of in the beds, in the perennial beds and stuff. She might have to do a little cultivation and, like you say, adding compost and so forth. Yeah. So we have a question from Margie in Beaverton, Oregon, who wrote in the comments on awaytogarden.com. Have we ever battled Canada thistle successfully? She has a patch of it that she dug out last year, and now it's back and spreading. We should say, first of all, that it's Cercium. Is it Arvense? A-R-V-E-N-S-E, Cercium. It's an alien plant. It's not a Native American thistle. And there are really good, really important American thistle species. So one needs to do an ID first before attacking your local thistle, okay? So we'll just put that as the caveat, right?
Yes. But this is one of the worst.
Yeah, this is the worst. This is the worst. And actually that species name means it's of cultivated fields, which means it's a widespread weed. You know what I mean? It gets out there and goes crazy. So it's really a bad news one.
She said she tried to dig it out or dug it out. But it's one of those ones where you leave a little piece of the root in and that you got another plant.
Correct. It turns out I read a little bit about it. I don't know. Last year I was reading about thistles. And even in its native range of like southeastern Europe and parts of the Mediterranean, it has no effective natural enemies. And it's considered a severe weed in agriculture there, too. So, boy, you know it's bad then when it on top of that gets to another habitat.
Wow.
So, yeah. So have you ever tackled it?
Yes.
And what did you do?
I used a chemical.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I'm always, you know, I don't want to use any ever. And this sort of gets to the ethical thing. But and that's right philosophically. But even the conservation organizations, like if they're doing a restoration, reclaiming an area that's badly invaded with alien plants, you know, Xerces Society or, you know, Audubon or whatever, they will have instructions. You know, they will be using for the greater good, not all the time. They're not relying on it all the time. But they will, in order to try to take back from a terrible invasive, right? They will do that. So I think you're saying the same thing. You're not, like, out there doing it all the time. But with something like this, you know you can't let it get out of hand.
Well, and I take a sprayer and I make a very thin stream and I go right up to the plant as early in the season as I can, so I'm not really getting anything else because it's up pretty much before everything.
Right.
And I just give a little spot of glyphosate right in the center of it, and that does help knock it back. And also, it hides. So you get the ones in the front and look in the back of the border because they're back there too. And I try to get them as much as possible.
So in doing some reading about it, there's a way that even if one decides to, in this case, use a chemical, the learning, the timing, the life history, the life cycle of the individual plant we're trying to target is super important. And in the case of Canada thistle, it turns out that the best times to direct that targeted spray, what you're talking about, are between the bud stage and the flowering stage, like not before bud stage when it's just at that rosette on the ground. It turns out it's because the plant has already sent a lot of its energy up into making the bud, preparing to flower, so it's a little weakened and vulnerable. And then also an even more valuable time or targeted time is as it's starting to decline a little bit, you know, sort of the end of the season when it's going to pull all the chemical down into the roots when it's...
So
it's real interesting to read up on the exact timing because you're doing the right thing, but then each plant has the specific timing. And places like Washington State University, and she's out in Oregon, so I was interested in, you know, is there anything special in the Northwest or various universities talk about mowing every, like, 2 weeks to 3 weeks for a whole growing season. And, you know, it can take years to eliminate it that way. You know, they're talking about agricultural situations. But the combined, in almost all the university extensions are recommending a mechanical, like a digging or mowing repeatedly, plus an herbicide, a combined attack.
So on our way to garden, can you give some directions on how we can find that information about when to...
Yeah, good idea, because we're almost out of time. But, because, I mean, I hate using, you know, the chemicals, like you said. But there are times when, for the greater good, as I said, I think we have to talk about, you know, as part of sort of an integrated pest management, a directed tactical approach, using the least toxic methods, but for the better result, rather than just letting these things run and abandon. But yeah, what I'll do is I'll track down a couple of the specific directions, fact sheets about it. But yeah, you're right. And every little bit left behind will potentially sprout a new plant. So especially bad. So yes, so we're down to the last moment here, Ken. So squandered another.
Is it spring yet, Margaret? Is it,
no.
I know the
no.
the calendar says it's spring.
No, it's not. It's not. It's absolutely not. But yeah, so I'll go out in the 30 degrees again and keep trying to, quote, clean up the garden. Good luck with that, right? So anyway, thank you for answering the questions. And thanks for telling me about those, like, mother and little baby plants and so forth, the violets. Interesting. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. Didn't know about that.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaythegarden.
So I'll be expecting a gift at any moment. And I'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Thanks, Margaret.
Okay. And I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, I hope, too. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. And find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.